On today's episode of the Photonos podcast, we're down to two people. We talk black and white photography, we both have car trouble, and discuss whether it's worth trying to protect your images. So, I've lost track of what episode we're on, but welcome to the Photonos podcast. We are down by one man today, aren't we?
We are two.
Yeah. Paul, well, it's difficult getting this all together, isn't it? Getting the three of us together. It's probably, we've learned from having a few gaps in it that we're not going to be able to either put one out every week with all three of us here. I think so. We've kind of come to the conclusion that we're going to have to record without one of us on occasion. Or the other alternative is not to put one out, isn't it? So,
I think that's fine.
We've decided we're going to.
I'm happy with this. Also going down the. Yeah.
You're happy that Paul's not here?
Yeah. It's great how we secretly managed to be available. Well, the only days that Paul wasn't. Yeah.
Paul said he was really busy on a Monday, so we're here on a Monday.
Yeah, it's the only day that we could do this week. What's the chances? Moving forward as well, we want to try and introduce some guests into the into the podcast. So maybe three people plus a guest might be a little bit too much, might be a little bit daunted. So there might well even be the case that this podcast could just be one person and a guest. Yeah. But as long as it's one of the three of us.
Yeah. Well, unless someone nicks it from us.
Anyway, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, very good.
A good week.
Yeah, I have, not too bad, apart from the car breaking down. But
yeah.
It's my fault, I'll be honest, because the car has been rolling with a dodgy clutch for quite a while.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and we've just got it through its MOT recently, and that costs like 400, 500 quid to get a few bits sort of repaired.
Right.
To get it through the MOT. So we haven't really had the money to get the clutch fixed, because it's a few hundred quid, isn't it, usually?
It's expensive getting a clutch fixed.
Yeah, it is. And then we've been putting up with it for a while, so I went off to a show. I was going to go down to the Peak District. It was last Wednesday, I think, when it was tanking down with rain.
Right.
I thought, I'm going to go up to Mam Tor, right, Peak District, because I've not been there for ages. I'm going to go up to Mam Tor and get a few shots in rain, basically.
Yeah.
Because I like the path on the tops there is nice. I thought, with a bit of like dramatic clouds behind and the path with rain covered, like,
I don't think I've been there.
Have wet and reflective there? I thought it would look really nice. And you've
nice,
got the fence run along there as well.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'm going to film in the rain, accepting I was going to get wet through.
Yeah.
Came off the M60, M1, I think it was, down towards the Peak District. And it had been fine. The car had been fine. Come up the ramp off the M1, up to the roundabout of the motorway, coming off it towards Sheffield. And I just could not move off the line at the roundabout. I was like, oh my God, I'm stuck literally on the slip road of the motorway.
So literally into first gear.
Yeah, didn't do anything. I think what had happened is that the clutch had, I don't particularly know how clutches work, but I think it got stuck, engaged, basically. So when I was pushing the clutch down, the clutch went really light.
Right. So it wouldn't allow you to engage first gear?
Yeah, I don't think
gear.
It would disengage,
Ah, right, okay.
I don't quite know how they work, but that's kind of what it felt like.
Friction.
Yeah, and then I panicked for a minute and just started revving it as hard as I could, and it just started rolling. So I was very, like, tentatively.
All right.
Because I've had a bit of driver training in my time, but, like, I kind of very tentatively got the speed going, tried to leave enough gap so I didn't have to brake again coming off the roundabout.
Right.
And managed to find it into, like, a little lay-by on the side of the road into Sheffield. I was like, oh, my God. Like, that was a day done, so. And then I left the AA a while ago, so I had to pay, like, a premium to get the AA to come in.
Because you're not a member of the AA.
Yeah. I used to be, but then I got it free through my old job for a bit. So,
right, I see.
I gave it up and then just never got.
So what did AA sting you for that then? How do you do you ring them up and say, yeah, I mean, I need help, but I'm not a member?
Yeah, they're quite good. I mean, that must happen all the time. It's just like, I think it was a £100 emergency call-out fee, and then the normal subscription or insurance policy, essentially, isn't it?
Oh, right, okay.
But to be fair, they came pretty quickly, and it really.
Do you then have to sign up for a year, though? Is that part of the deal?
No, you can cancel any time still, but you're not getting that £100 back, basically.
Right.
So that's a one-off call-out fee for not being a member.
Yeah, that's fine, but they're charging you £100, which I get.
Yeah.
But do they then insist that you sign up for a year as well?
No, it's £8 a month, and you can cancel any time.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, it's not too bad, but do you know, as breakdowns go, it wasn't too bad. Like, it could have been so much worse, but like, it just meant that that was my only opportunity to get out shooting last week.
There is nothing worse.
So that led to me, I then had to, the video that I put out Sunday just gone, I had to do it in my office because I was stranded.
I just got my car out of a garage once and I was heading out to photograph a boxing match. And I was on the M62 and I'd literally just been on the M62 for 5 minutes. And you know when you go over the tops, it's the highest point in England.
Yeah.
Just between Huddersfield and...
Highest motorway point, isn't it?
Yeah, highest motorway point. Yeah, yeah. Sorry. Between Huddersfield and Manchester. And, I'd be really embarrassed to tell you the story, but I was quite literally driving. I had I had toast on my lap and I was eating toast with one hand. I had a cup of coffee in the other hand when I was driving. this is serious. Right, please don't start shouting at me because I know you're not supposed to do it. But I am driving an automatic car, so it pretty much does everything for you. I'm in the outside lane. I got right to the very, very top, Windy Hill, all the way up there.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, my car has just come from the garage, by the way. What's the worst thing that could happen? The bonnet flew up.
No, it did not.
The bonnet flew up all the way back off its hinges, smashed into the roof.
Really?
The roof collapsed. And I'm driving a Jaguar S-Type at the time. Roof collapsed. Windscreen smashed.
Oh
I'm holding a cup of coffee and eating some toast at the same time.
Did you burn yourself?
I swear to God, yeah. It's the strangest thing. I didn't crash. It's that instant panic thing, do you do? Because all of a sudden you just can't see a thing. And you're driving at probably 75, 80 miles an hour in the outside lane of the M62. And all I did is I just leant down and looked between the gap between the bonnet and the...
It's lucky it didn't fly off behind, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it smashed. It wrote the car off, you know. That action... Really? Wrote the car off.
It must have damaged the
No, and all I did then is I could see people coming towards me, right? I could see them more. The guys beside me didn't actually realise because when I was trying to pull in, the guy was beeping me and he wouldn't let me in.
Yeah.
And I had to force him over till eventually, right, he was probably thinking, who's this idiot? And eventually when I moved over, he realised, oh my God, his bonnet's up and his windscreen's all smashed. Yeah, and that was just a short while ago, right, actually.
Is what I think you're in that state though when you're driving, even if you're eating at the same time, which you probably shouldn't do. But I was never a traffic cop. But you're in that sort of heightened state anyway, aren't you?
Yeah.
Of like concentration and kind of on edge. You're always on edge a little bit when you're driving. I think that's why people get so upset behind the wheel.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Because you're so het up anyway, trying to keep the car on the road, that as soon as someone and you're concentrating so hard. That as soon as someone beeps at you, you get immediately angry, don't you? Like, because you're already in that sort of stressed state a little bit.
Yeah.
So people just react. Like,
I'll tell you what, though, that bonnet, because obviously on the Jag, it's a big, big bonnet, and it came up and smashed straight in, all bowed the roof of the car. It's quite scary, but to be fair, I kept it cool and eventually pulled over, and I was just stood on the side of the road, still eating my toast,
losing your
cool. The phone to the AA. Or green flag.
Jeez.
I'm currently...
I mean, one of the things that sort of it pointed out for me this week is that you're just so reliant on your car, aren't you, as a photographer and a landscape photographer?
Yeah.
Like, there's times when I've done weddings before and you've got to drive between the church and the reception venue. And you're thinking, what would happen if my car broke down right now? Like, it's... You're kind of so reliant on it, aren't you? Same for landscape photography. Like, it's just... A lot of the places we go are fairly remote with terrible rural kind of public transport. It's a bit of a shame, really, isn't it? Like, everyone... We're all driving our cars out into these beautiful locations, aren't we?
We've been shooting weddings for a long time and we had to travel down to Sheffield from Huddersfield and we decided to go the back roads because... The weather was horrendous. There was torrential rain for hours and hours and it's flooding everywhere.
Yeah.
And parts of the M62 and the M1 were closed off. It was that horrendous. But obviously, as a wedding photographer, you can't just ring up and pull a sickie or say, you know, the weather's a bit bad, I can't make it. Come hell and high water.
You're just kind of hoping everyone's having the same problem.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we were thinking. So we went along the back roads and a road was closed. It was closed due to flooding.
Right.
And... I was just that guy that went past all the traffic and I just trickled all the way through, and it came up to the door sills. Didn't come into the car, to be fair, but that gets you panicking now, because that's freezing cold water on your hot engine. Yeah. So I was more concerned about that than water actually coming into the car, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Or worse still, because you don't really know how deep that water is.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, long story short, we actually made it. We got all the way down to the venue with literally 5 minutes to spare from the actual wedding ceremony. And we were one of the first people there. So all that panic and it turned out to be quite a good day, because that was a good story for everybody then. Yeah. Yeah, everybody had their tale of how eventually they got to the wedding, and it was quite good.
Yeah, that's
good. But yeah, you are very reliant on your car, or van in my case.
Yeah.
My builder's van, as people have pointed out.
Yeah. It's nice. Has it been good having the van? Like, it's something I've considered so many times, is getting a van, but...
You need a van.
I need a van.
My mate Lee said
to
me...
Why do I need a van?
My mate said to me, Lee said, if you have a van, he said, you'll never look back. And honestly, it's just awesome. It's fantastic.
Has it been all right for nipping down the country roads and stuff? Because I know you can, but it's just...
Well, yeah, because I drive a Vauxhall Vivaro, so a Vauxhall Vivaro next to my Jaguar is actually smaller than the Jaguar.
Is it?
Yeah, and I take the car everywhere without blinking.
Yeah.
It's just literally because it's so boxy, you get the impression it's wider or longer than it actually is. But when they're parked side by side, then no, there's no issues whatsoever. But it's just great because I sleep in the van. I can carry anything I want without stating the obvious. And it's just it's like a shed. It's like a shed on wheels.
Because I'd been spending about 20 years of my life desperate to get a camper van.
Right.
And then I hired... that one, when I did the collaboration with Morton in Scotland.
Right.
And it kind of burst the balloon for me, really, like, because I didn't particularly enjoy the camper van experience.
Okay.
Partly because it didn't feel like there was that much space, because I'm obviously quite a big lad.
Big unit.
So when... it was quite a stacked out van. There was a lot of stuff in the cupboards and stuff. So there wasn't really that much storage space. Other than the space that is your living space.
It's a massive camper van. You normally drive around in your car, for pity's sake.
I know, but like it was, I found it a real faff. I'd much rather just pitch a tent for 20 minutes.
Oh, right, okay.
And then have my car. Like it was, and also when I was sleeping as well, I had a lot of condensation from obviously me breathing, but
yeah,
I had it ventilated as well. And it's still, so I just, it's kind of killed my desire to get a camper van. But Morton, who I was with, had a 7-berth motorhome, which was incredible. So yeah. It was like worlds apart.
Yeah.
Even it was like a TARDIS as well, because it didn't look that big from the back. It was quite a long wheelbase one, but didn't look that big from outside. Go inside that thing, and it was like a little apartment. Brilliant. So I definitely do. What I want to do actually is a bit of a tour. Do you know the 500 thing around?
Yeah.
The Scottish
Northern Scotland. Yeah.
I'd love to do that in a motorhome.
Yeah,
because it's all beautiful views from the road, isn't it? So you can hike, just park up, and they're so relaxed about the sort of camping as well, aren't they, in Scotland? So it's, you can kind of just leave.
Not quite as petty as they are here in the UK.
No.
Say UK and England, should I say?
I guess it's partly because there's less people, though, isn't there?
Mm.
You can, if you've got, like in the Lake District, you'd have, if it was allowed, you'd have camper vans in every single parking space, wouldn't you? Like, people pitching up sleeping, so...
I need to add my van detail and information onto one of my vlogs, because I find it quite fascinating. And I bought a Vauxhall Vivaro, and there's probably guys listening now who drive around in a Vivaro for work as a plumber or an electrician, and probably thinking, what on earth is he talking about? But I bought one with a crew cabinet so I could take people out and about.
Yeah, that's nice, that.
And it is really good, because it then becomes like a family car with a massive boot, without stating the obvious. And the idea was... When I decided not to take people out and about, I can remove the crew cab and convert it.
How do you do that, though?
They just bolt it in.
Oh, right.
They are quite literally bolted in.
Okay.
I'm making it sound like as if I'm a mechanic, by the way, but they are quite literally just bolted in.
Right.
But you could take that out. You could buy kits for it and convert it to a camper van, or, of course, get it converted to a camper van professionally, because it seems to be a very popular model. But since I've had it, I've discovered that I can sleep in the crew cab comfortably. I've been away for a week twice now, 2 1-week sessions, and just slept in the back of the van. But you're not sat down on a reclined seat. I've got it set up so that if you imagine your back seats, I've got two boxes in front of me there. So that basically, it's like a shelf. It takes it right across. Then I put a big airbed in there.
Right.
And it goes from corner to corner. I just simply lower the driver's seat, move it forward. So if I want to stretch out, because I'm 6'4", I can sleep just at a very slight angle, full width.
That's all right,
or full length. And it's absolutely fantastic for no money at all.
Yeah. So that was the sort of thing I was expecting with the camper van. It wasn't. I was expecting high levels of comfort.
Right.
And it just wasn't.
Wow.
It was a bit of a faff. But I think if I had that, where you're just kind of expecting to sleep in a car.
Yeah.
And you're roughing it a little bit, aren't you?
I
think I'd be all right with that.
It's like wild camping. You know what to expect when you wild camp, don't you?
That's how I think I operate my whole life like that. Either in total comfort or total discomfort, where you're roughing it and working hard and stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like the area in the middle, I'm not a massive fan of, where you're a little bit comfortable and a little bit uncomfortable. You've got a little bit of luxury.
This is like a motor show.
I know. That's everything though. I kind of like the extremes, like either total comfort or like roughing
Welcome
it on
to
a
this
wild,
week's
wild
motorsport podcast.
Should we talk about photography then?
Oh God, if we must, yeah. No, but you have to buy one. Why are you thinking about buying one?
No, I don't think so. I think you said to me earlier off camera that I'd be better off with like an estate car or something. That's probably what I'll go with next.
You can sleep in an estate car.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. I think I'll do as long as I can get one where it all folds flat at the back.
Right.
I think that'll do me, won't it?
Yeah, that's it. Little airbed.
I'll just keep wild camping.
Yeah, cool. Right, let's talk about photography then. First subject, probably close to our hearts. Let's talk black and white.
Mm. We mentioned it briefly, I think, didn't we? Possibly on the video the other week. Do you shoot a lot of black and white?
I do. I shoot an awful lot of black and white. Are we just sticking with landscape
photography?
No, everything.
I'm interested in it all.
Yeah, certainly with... I don't know what the rules are with black and white. In other words, I'll just look at a picture and then think whether I would prefer that in black and white. And sometimes I'll convert it to black and white and I don't like how it looks in black and white. And sometimes, without stating, you obviously look at a picture and think, that's definitely... could do with a conversion to mono, and then that would work much better. But I don't have any rules and regulations. If I do wedding photography, you tend to find that anything in bad light, like churches, it's not so much a secret, but wedding photographers tend to shoot those in black and white.
Yeah.
And that's usually to hide lots of ailments within pictures.
Yeah.
Because black and white is very good for that, isn't it?
It's brilliant. I mean, I used to use that all the time in my wedding photography in a darkened church, like you say, the colour doesn't always come through, does it?
And
if you've got to bump the ISO up, if you're not using flash during the ceremony, like the noise actually, I think a lot of the time the noise actually looks quite good in black and white, almost like film grain, doesn't it? But
yeah,
no, it's not quite the same. But I like those kind of high ISO shots in black and white.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I don't mind a bit of grain, a bit of noise. It's okay. I think we panic a bit too much about noise and grain on images.
Yeah, I mean, it is much more obvious in colour, though, isn't it? The noise. That's the because it introduces colour as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. If you have a civil ceremony, we've been to loads of venues where they have a civil ceremony, and the walls will be orange, and you'll get that horrible orange or green cast across people.
Yeah.
And it's just a nightmare to try and fix straight away. Save all the time, all the hassle, straight to black and white. And it uniforms pictures as well, I think.
How do you convert to black and white? What do you use?
Straight into Photoshop.
Right.
Convert it. I use ACR. The conversion to black and white in ACR is very good now. I do tend to use that quite a bit.
Do you move away from the auto setting when you... shift to black and white, or do you just...
I just like... To be honest, all I tend to do is make my black and whites a bit punchier. Mm-hmm. I just tend to add a bit more contrast.
Yeah, I do that.
Deeper blacks, slightly brighter whites.
Because when I do it, obviously on Lightroom are similar, aren't they? But I do it in Lightroom, and I use the auto setting quite... Just hit the black and white button, so it does the auto setting with all the colour.
And then tweak it.
The tones. I very rarely tweak the tones these days, because I think Lightroom does a really good job of getting them about right, and then I push the contrast quite a long way on my black and white images. There's sometimes when I'll put a strong contrast curve on, and then push the contrast slider and adjust the blacks and whites as well. And then if you ever turn it back to colour, just to have a look, you go, oh my God, that's awful. Because you're only pushing the tones, aren't you?
That's right.
It works really well.
I'm the same as you. I tend to keep mine on auto. I do. When I said about tweaking the image, I meant reference to your whites, your shadows, and so on and so forth, your blacks.
I was thinking about it the other week, actually, because I think we mentioned black and white on one of the podcasts, and I started having a bit of a look into it to just thinking about how I could do more of it, because for some reason the black and white images landscapes particularly don't seem to be that popular sometimes these days. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that is. I guess it's like we mentioned the other week as well, because the saturated colours seem to do really well online, don't they? Whereas black and white is
certainly Instagram.
Yeah. But then you look at someone like Ansel Adams, who only shot in black and white. And that got me thinking, why did he do that? And then I realised, like, I was looking into something else about processing film photography. Someone said that you used to be able to bracket film. That was why I was talking about bracketing, which is not strictly true, I don't think. Don't hold me to fact here, but Ansel Adams essentially stuck to black and white because of the part of the process of pulling different exposures out of the same frame in film, which I don't totally understand how it works, and I'm not an expert by any means, but there was something about the black and white film that they were using at that time that allowed you to take different exposures off the same bit of film or something. Can't quite realise how it would be. That at the time, that you couldn't do that with colour film. You could only have the one. So it was essentially like bracketing film photography, and you could adjust it in post-production a bit like we do now with bracketed shots, but you could only do it with black and white and not with colour.
All right,
so I think that's part of the reason that Ansel Adams stuck to so much black and white photography, because he could adjust so much in post-production.
We need to speak to our man, Mr. O'Nions.
Yeah.
Ask him. I've been there.
Yeah.
We'll speak to him. No, I didn't know that. I've obviously shot and filmed for years, but I didn't realise in the post-processing side that you could manipulate your black and white images more than you
Because I'm by no means an expert, but he obviously did a lot of dodging and burning.
Yeah.
But I think it's something to do with the way the film works, and you can use it for different. You can use a negative. I don't know. I'm going way off what I actually know I'm talking about here. But it's something along those lines that you couldn't do with colour film.
I understand what you're saying. No, totally.
But that then got me thinking. I do want to do more black and white sort of landscape photography. And I've done some in the past. I think it works particularly well with long exposures at times. One of my sort of favourite images that I've taken is of the Second Severn Bridge. I think you were down there not too long ago, weren't you?
Yeah.
I've got a really nice sort of black and white long exposure of that. I think black and white landscapes work. So in a similar way to, I think, what we're talking about with the weddings as well, is that you can, if you've got colour that isn't particularly interesting, like a kind of rusty brown Severn River.
Yeah.
Like,
it's exactly what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's all sand, isn't it? But if you can turn that black and white, you lose that. And you're then focusing just on the tone rather than the actual colour of it. And those, in some situations like that, the tones are as interesting as the colour, aren't they? And that's what you're kind of exploiting in with black and white.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at something like Instagram, when they're talking about this thing called the grid, how your pictures look as a grid, then again, this is where black and white works so well. Because, you know, if you've got a lovely summer seascape in colour with vibrant blues and all the rest of it, then you've got a cloudy day next to it, but still in colour, they don't mate very well together.
That sounds a bit like my Instagram.
Obviously I'm the same as well. But if you had four pictures that were all in black and white, even if one was a street photography shot, another one was a landscape, they mate as a grid.
Yeah, that's true, because you get some photographers who have a really particular post-processing style.
Yeah.
And they'll put a lot of filters on there and a lot of tone, different like split toning and stuff. And on Instagram, it looks really good because they've got such a consistent look throughout their work. Whereas I probably consider myself a more natural landscape photographer. So I do end up with grey ish looking pictures and then really colourful ones. And they don't always, you've got to be really careful how you match them up. But on Instagram, which is a bit of a chronological type display, isn't it? Because you post them when you take them generally. It does mismatch sometimes. But you're right, with black and white, I think what's good with black and white is that when you're putting those images together, you don't have to, you don't have to worry about the colour. You can concentrate on how shape fits together with putting images side by side, which is really interesting.
It's true. My black and whites on my wedding photography and my portrait side are all identical.
In terms of contrast? And
in terms of, I have a black and white with a very, very slight brown tinge that I'm very slight. Not sepia, nothing sickly like that. But I think it's also important to keep consistency throughout your work. Mm. Like you said, if you look through my wedding pictures, you could put any of the black and white side by side and they will look identical in terms of, I was going to say in terms of colour, but in terms of shade, like you mentioned.
Yeah, that's definitely the case for wedding photography, isn't it? Because if someone's hired you based on what they've seen of your work and they love your work, if you then went and created a load of saturated images for their wedding, it wouldn't be right, would it?
No. But the point I'm making is you go on lots of people's websites and there'll be black and white with a hint of yellow next to a black and white with a hint of blue. And so as much as they're black and white, that slight hint now means they're not related. Does that make sense?
If they're not doing it consistently, you mean?
If they're not doing it consistent throughout their website.
No, I agree. Because it looks at, I love putting a blue tone on my black and white images.
Yeah.
What do I use? The Google Nick, oh, it was Google, it's DxO now, isn't it? The Nick collection.
Yeah.
They've got a really lovely set of tones in there that match old film sort of colour and tones.
But that's fine if you keep it consistent.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it just looks, some of the blue tones and stuff I think look really nice. And it provides a cooler feeling to it, but I'm a massive fan of that. It looks, most of my black and white images now I will do that with. Because I just think it looks really nice. It's not necessarily a black and white image anymore. It's still monochrome, isn't it? But not necessarily.
Clouds can look fantastic in black and white. You know, when you get that really grungy day when you're out and about, you know, with those deep, dark skies and white, moody clouds against the dark sky, if that makes sense. You convert that to black and white, that can look fantastic. That could be lost with, you know, you get a real storm-looking sky out to sea, but there's a tinge of blue sky in the background. Mm. It no longer looks as if it's...
Yeah, that's right.
You know, that moody sky.
It gives you all... It almost gives you a bigger artistic freedom in post-production, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
Because you can... I love some of those shots where there's... You pull like a really heavy gradient down on the sky and make it really black almost. Yeah. So it just creates that... Especially if it's sort of like a vignette as well. It creates that real sense of mood and...
You know, when you convert images to black and white, I tend to find if you use your color sliders, so you know, you can convert an image to black and white, and then you convert how the blues convert to grayscale and the yellows and so on and so forth. I always find you're very, very limited with what you can do with those sliders because it very quickly affects the picture in a bad way.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got. Is it the luminance of it that it's affecting, I think, the brightness of a particular colour?
I'm not sure, but when you, certainly for reds and blues, when you start playing around with reds and blues, that really alters how your image is converted to black and white. But to move the slider really more than half an inch, now all of a sudden the skies start really looking bitty and looking horrible. So you are very restricted in what you can do with those sliders or how much you can move them.
It does affect the brightness of each image, doesn't it? Of each colour, sorry. With the sliders, but red converts the black and white really nicely, doesn't it?
It's generally just the red and the blue, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was the old days of putting red or blue filters in front of your lenses. what about I mentioned one thing in there, street photography.
Yeah.
Street photography is absolutely fantastic in black and white. I pretty much convert unless it's something of interest with certain colours. In a street picture, more often than not, they're all black and white for me.
Yeah, I mean that I don't do a lot of street photography myself, but if it's not a specific portrait in the street where someone's looking at the camera, I think that black and white works amazingly well for that, doesn't it? Because
Why don't you do street photography? Have you ever tried it? Have you ever thought about it?
I have. I mean, I have obviously tried it, but I don't particularly like the feeling of kind of observing from the outside. I know a lot of people do, but I don't like the idea of taking someone's picture when they're not looking at me. I'm not saying it's wrong by any means. I just don't want to do that. Like, I think as a photographer, I want to feel like I'm more than just an observer, if you know what I mean. Because I probably haven't really thought this through, but like, say at a wedding, if you're the photographer, there are pictures, times when you're taking pictures when people are not looking at you.
Sure.
But people know you're there.
Yes.
People, if you're a guest at a wedding,
you know
you're having your photograph taken, yeah. Don't you, all day long, and it's kind of an agreed permission, isn't it, essentially?
Yeah.
So and as a wedding photographer, you are most definitely part of the wedding, aren't you? And you're part of the experience of, and I feel like that doing landscape photography as well. It's like me, my camera in the landscape.
Sure.
Whereas I think if you're doing street photography, you're kind of just an outside observer, aren't you? Which is cool. Like, I love looking at street photography. I just don't. It doesn't particularly speak to me as a genre. Maybe it's because I'm not very good at it. I don't know.
Well, you don't know unless you try it, though. But there's no point trying something you're not comfortable with. But I'm guessing if you did try it and came away with an image or two that you're very happy with, I think that's where you get the bug from.
Yeah,
it's like trying to convince somebody, hey, it's a great idea to walk up a hill in the rain, hoping that the rain stops so that you can take a picture of the other side of the hill. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But once you do it, and you do it a couple of times, you think, wow, this is really exhilarating.
One of my colleagues at Light and Land is a guy called Damien de Mulder. He does a lot of street photography. And some of the images he gets are beautiful, with just like the use of, these are all in black and white as well, just the use of shape.
Yeah.
And just like using like
lines.
an escalator or a handrail or something with a light reflecting off it. And it's just, I just wouldn't think in that way. I don't think. I haven't tried, but
it is, it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder than people, you know, think.
Yeah.
It really is quite difficult because you have to see things in a very different way.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Because it's not like, say if you go to the Lake District, right?
Yeah.
You go there, even if you've never been there before, and you're like, wow,
that is
amazing.
Yeah.
But with really good street photography, you're looking at stuff that you look at every single day.
You stood outside Boots the Chemist.
Yeah, exactly.
Looking at people walking past with shopping bags in their hands, trying to think, how can I make, you know, this an interesting picture?
And like a tube station or something that millions of people go through every day.
Yeah.
And you're seeing something unique almost, which seems bizarre in that.
And you almost want a bright sunny day. Yeah. You know, so it casts shadows.
Big contrast, yeah.
Yeah, that's what you want. Lines and shapes and contrast.
That does really appeal to me, and something I wanted to kind of fit into my landscape photography actually is that the relationship between the highlights and the shadows that works so well in street photography.
Sure.
And obviously works even better on a sunny day. That's something I'd quite like to explore within my landscape photography, because a bright sunny day isn't necessarily the best time for landscape photography, but that going black and white is an option, isn't it? If you can use those same principles that I've just talked about for street photography in your landscapes. So the way a tree casts a shadow across, do you know what I mean? It's kind of that.
It's exactly the same thing,
but in a landscape.
Yeah. You're not upsetting people.
True. Yeah, I do. I mean,
you also tend to find that you do it in a quite covert way. So in other words, let's say for an example, I was out shooting street last week and I can see a picture. So you compose the picture and then you're almost waiting for somebody to walk into the frame or a bicycle to come whizzing past to just add a bit more information, a bit more detail, a bit more excitement in the frame and so on, and tell a better story. And then you tend to do it almost covert-like. So you could see a cyclist coming down the road. So you're looking at your camera, you might be looking down. So he's not thinking, what's that guy doing with a camera pointing at me? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, so I always tell people, shoot with your iPhone. Hold your iPhone up, and if you plug your headpiece in, you can take pictures.
Oh, really?
So you can literally, If I'm like this, I could even pretend to be talking to somebody and I could be snapping pictures off and nobody would ever know. So,
do you do street stuff with your phone?
No. No, but I do advise people if you want to get...
I don't see why you couldn't know. Like, it was...
Oh, yeah, there are lots of people who could because, I mean, obviously, phone cameras are fantastic now, aren't they? Yeah. But, no, I do advise people if they want to get into it and a little bit nervous, maybe worried about confrontation with people, just simply get... I'm saying iPhone. Obviously, get your smartphone, your phone... and plug your headset in and you'll find when it's on camera mode, you can just press a button. Yeah. And you can quit, even like if you wanted to go one stage further and just pretend you're talking to somebody and start snapping away. And nobody will be any the wiser because everybody does it.
There was a funny thing I saw relatively recently. Have you ever seen one of those, like BBC, it's usually like local BBC news or something. And if they're talking about fat people, like... someone like you and I, and what they'll do every time they do that, they'll go out into the street and they'll just film people's bellies.
Have
you ever seen it?
Yeah.
And they're saying like, obviously they're not identifying the person because they're just shooting their fat stomach. I was thinking, that's all. It's all. Imagine being that person, right? You're the producer and you say to the cameraman, right, you need to go out and film a load of fat people's stomachs. And they were saying like...
And backsides.
Yeah, they were saying, what you need to do if you don't want to be ever filmed like that, just have something that says... screw you, I'm fat, or something rude on the like wear it across your stomach so they can't they can't use it if they film your tummy.
I love that.
That'd be good. Oh god, imagine if that was you.
That is quite cool, isn't it? I was photographing last week on the street, and I was being interviewed while we were walking down the street, and we were in Cardiff, and walking down the street being interviewed, just like a selfie, side by side, chatting, and and I could see this guy walking beside us, a security man. We're in the high street.
Right.
So I looked across, you know, mid-flow of this interview, and I said, yes, pal, can I help you? And he goes, can I just ask what you're doing? Security guy. So I said, no. He said, well, I believe you're filming yourselves. I said, well, all right, okay. Yes, we are. He says, you're not allowed. What? We're on the high street in Cardiff, and this guy, quite literally a security guy, came up and said, you're not allowed to film on the streets. So I said to him, well, you've got two choices, pal. We're going to continue talking and filming. So you either fight me to stop me or ring the police. Well, I'll ring the police. I said, well, ring the police then. Anyway, we carried on walking. He's walking behind us and he's going, red Oscar to such and such, red Oscar to such and such. And another guy came out, right? And this guy was really in my face and getting quite arsy with me. This other guy came out. And he goes, can I ask what you're doing, please? And he's really kind of diffused the situation. Mm. I said, we're doing street photography. He said, that's okay then. Have a good day.
What did they think you were doing?
So even though we had a camera, and it's only a small camera, G7X on a small GoPro, a small tripod, sorry. People take selfies and walk and talk into their cameras all the time.
Yeah.
Does this security person think that, you know, you can't do that anymore? I don't understand it. So you do, and you can find yourself in confrontational scenarios sometimes, but you're still perfectly legal to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I used to sort of deal with when I was in the police.
Oh, did you?
Like, not dealing with other people, but say if there was some kind of incident that was relatively high profile, or there was a disturbance in the street that you were trying to arrest somebody or something, you'd quite often have people coming out and filming you because they're either just interested or they're trying to capture some sort of police brutality on camera. But then what a lot of cops didn't understand is that they're perfectly entitled to do that. I mean, we're going a few years back here just as phone cameras were coming out. But... Some officers used to get quite upset about it, and they'd go and confront the person and say, well, you can't film this. And you kind of thinking, yeah, they can. To be honest, like, there's different, it depends who you are as to how you deal with it, isn't there? In terms of if you're a photographer and you're shooting and someone comes and asks you to stop, it's down to you to really decide how you're going to deal with it. But very rarely do you have to do exactly what they're telling you. But the one place where I haven't had an issue, but a lot of people have, is when I was doing the cityscape stuff in London, and I got set up on had the tilt shift lens with me, So I did a three-shot panorama, long exposure, six-minute exposure of Tower Bridge across the river to London, the Tower of London, and then the city as well. So it was an 18-minute exposure, basically, of 3 6-minute exposures. And I just popped myself next to the wall overlooking the river, set my tripod up, whacked it on the camera and did it. And then when I came away, I didn't know this at the time, but when I came away and posted the video, loads of people were saying, didn't you have any problem with the tripod police?
Yeah.
I was like, no, not at all.
I've had it as well.
But I think they do, but I think that's privately owned land, isn't it? And they can tell you to remove the tripod, I think.
Well, they
or they can eject you from the...
They can't legally because, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's privately owned land, but it's land that's privately owned, granting access to the public.
Yeah.
So that's part of the rules and regulations. They can't just buy that land, then close it down and close the shops because it's a public right of way. So by virtue of the fact it's a public right of way, public have the right to do what public do in public places.
Yeah. I guess in hindsight, I thought about it a little bit, and I guess seeing it from their point of view, you don't want 100 tourists on the side of the Thames looking at Tower Bridge with tripods there, to be fair.
No, but, no, you're right. There has to be, you've got to be intelligent about it, really. But it is very, very annoying. They're paying these people to police the streets. But you know what's really strange is when we were out photographing, I think we were still out photographing about 7 o'clock at night when we were doing the street, and those guys weren't around then.
No.
So it's fine then, is it? Yeah, after 5 o'clock when they go home, it's no longer illegal.
Maybe it is when there's less people. When there's less people about, they're not as concerned about it.
It's just, I just find it really bizarre. Yeah, but you do get quite a bit of hassle in certain areas in London, and that frustrates the hell out of me.
I think it's like there is. I'm not sure if it's kind of a general British attitude though, because I think we are quite reserved, aren't we, as British people? I'm not sure we like being filmed ever, because I think say some Americans, like, they're much more prepared to be on camera. Like, if I've had it on occasions where I've been filming and people do not want to be anywhere near my camera, which is fair enough, but that isn't your right, like, either. It's different for a professional commercial setup, isn't it? But as a normal sort of enthusiast photographer, you can film or shoot whatever you want, can't you, pretty much?
There are new rules and regulations that have just come into play. However, in a public place, you're legally entitled to photograph anything. Look at paparazzis, for instance.
Yeah.
I'm literally photographing you and earning money off your celebrity status. That's weird, but they get away with it.
Yeah, I don't know all the rules and regulations, to be fair, but doesn't that just apply to commercial work? Is it different for personal shooting?
It's public doing public things in public places. How many times can you get the word public in one sentence?
I don't know.
It's quite strange because Jeremy Clarkson on his latest TV program, I'm not sure if you watch the new whatever Top Gear, whatever it's called. And he said they had this challenge where they had to try and get papped as many times as they could. This is really weird. So he was in London. I can't remember what his story was, but I think he had a car in London, pretended to break down, pretending that he had a flat tire and they needed to change the tire.
Yeah.
So basically he stood there with another celebrity friend who I'd never heard of, changing this tire in London to try and find out how many times they could get papped. So they got papped quite a few times, and the images went on various news sources around. Oh, Jeremy, was out in this street, and all of a sudden there's all these photographs. And he wanted to show those photographs of himself on his own show.
Right.
They wanted to charge him something like £110,000 for the rights to use the pictures
of him.
Of him.
Yeah.
It's most bizarre.
That's crazy, isn't it?
But isn't that really, that's weird.
That is crazy.
But that means that somebody has literally taken a picture and gained profit from his status, his celebrity status.
That leads on to the other thing we were going to talk about briefly is protecting your images. So like that, that's essentially a photographer make, trying to protect and make money from their image, isn't it?
Yep.
Whether you like it or not.
Yep.
But do you do anything to protect your images?
No, I don't, and I should do really. But watermarking images are worthless. I've had images.
Why is that? Why do you think that?
Because they're removable. And especially if in wedding photography, it's almost like if you as a guest lift pictures from my website, from obviously your friend's wedding that you were at, then more often than not, they'll even leave the logo on there. Yeah. Now, unless, of course, my logo was across the whole of the image, which would then spoil the image.
Yeah.
So there's various ways of looking at this. More often than not, you just put a logo in the corner. So if anybody does like the picture, they can at least look at the logo and say, all right, this is where that was shot.
Mm.
But I don't even do that half the time.
No, I think I agree. I think logos are relatively pointless in terms of protecting your image.
Yeah.
Because if someone's going to nick it, they can either clone it out or just crop it out, can't they?
Sure.
But I'm not against watermarks as a whole. I don't use them on my stuff. But I think if someone wants to use it to represent it as their work, I think that's fair enough. But I'd much prefer to see it in a digital border. Do you know what I mean? Like, so say if you're doing it not to protect your work, but to market yourself.
Right.
Just put like a digital white border around the image and then put it on there. So it doesn't, do you know
right,
what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
it doesn't,
yes.
So it doesn't distract the image.
So there's a name on the frame.
Essentially, yeah. Mm. Like you've just signed, almost like you've signed your name on the mount or
sure.
On the border of the image. Like,
yeah.
I think that's a much better way of doing it, but doing it over the actual image.
You've lost the wow factor.
Yeah. And
I can understand why people do it in certain circumstances.
I don't think it protects you though, does it?
Even if the image is a low res, 72 DPI online is a really low res image. But at 1024, you can then blow that up twice as big and print it, and it'll still print perfectly fine.
Yeah, I mean,
so
to be honest, I don't spend any time worrying about protecting my images, because if someone in 2019, if you put an image online, then someone can nick it and do something with it, can't they? And it's almost impossible to stop it. Even if you do put low resolution images on there, people can still end up using it. And I want to share my work online, because I want lots of people to see it. So I don't spend any time worrying about it. And I have had people use my images at various times, some commercial, some not. I even get people emailing me and saying how they love it as a desktop background.
Sure.
And I'm thinking, that's a little bit cheeky. Because I haven't put it out there for that. And if I had...
Thanks for your picture. Looks great above my fireplace.
Yeah, I might charge you £5 for a desktop background collection. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't, but you could do, couldn't you?
Yeah.
I think there is a slight difference if it's for personal use.
That's outrageous.
It's funny though. Like, I just find it funny, like, that people think it's all right. But I don't...
I'm just waiting for my screensaver to pop up on my phone now with your picture on it.
But if it's... But if it's for personal use and rather than commercial gain, it's not as bad, is it? But there are people that are doing it for commercial gain. But the way I see publishers operating now is they'll just take an image, not think anything of it. If the photographer comes back to them later and says, you've used my image without permission, they'll just give them £20 or something, don't they? And the problem goes away. So for the publishers, it's really not worth their while asking in advance, is it? It's like they're asking forgiveness rather than permission.
I've had pictures in the Sun of mine and without permission. And when I contacted them, just a bog standard answer that came back. Oh, we're really sorry. We thought it came from a free source. Just let us know how much we owe you. And that's really it. So in other words, yes, they'll just use and use and use and then put up with the consequences afterwards.
Yeah.
That's it.
Because they've got more money than you, haven't they? Like,
absolutely.
If there's any legal... As the photographer, though, like... Personally, I want to sort of be moving forwards. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I've taken an image and I've published it somewhere, even if I'm selling it as a print, if that image then gets stolen, I say stolen in sort of air quotes, but I don't particularly want to have to worry about that image again. Even if someone steals it, and I might have lost out on £100, say, I would rather just move on and forget about it than spend a load of time trying to get that £100 back. I might send an email and say, thanks for using my image. Do you know what I mean? Something doesn't take much time, but in terms of getting a lawyer and going down that, it's just, I think I can probably make more money by moving forwards into the next thing rather than looking back and trying to.
I think it also depends what they use your picture for.
Yeah.
Was it Chelsea and Tony Northrup? We've mentioned them again. have you heard the story that he took a picture of Chelsea, the woman, isn't it?
Yeah.
He took a picture of Chelsea, his wife.
Right.
I think they were just doing some kind of demonstration about how good the bokeh looked at a particular picture. And next minute, you know, that actual picture that that they took appeared as... it was like a marketing product for a hair shampoo or something. But that was the actual picture they used to promote that product.
Right.
Now, that's different. That's
I think that
outrageous.
I think it's the same thing, but it's about what's the value of you pursuing it. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So, and what's your intention as well? So if your intention is just to get the money back, if it's a big commercial thing like that and the money is £10,000, then yeah, you're going to chase it, aren't you? But
I think
for me, I would only ever, my reaction would depend on what I'm getting out of it. And I want to keep that my life as stress-free as possible. And any kind of litigation, it's creating stress, isn't it? But if
life's too short.
Exactly. Oh, absolutely. If the potential is, if it's being used in a big publication, or say if your image suddenly appears on the desktop background that's included with Microsoft Office or whatever, Windows or whatever, you're going to think, hang on a minute, that's my picture. Like, it's appearing on millions of people's screens all over the world. I'd like a little cheese for that, please.
Yeah, a little tickle.
Yeah, it's kind of, you'd probably pursue that one, wouldn't you? But
yeah,
I'm sure Microsoft wouldn't do that. But
It's interesting. No, it's very interesting.
Although, do you remember, I'm sure I heard, do you remember Windows 95? The very one had that like kind of picture of the hill and the clouds.
Yeah.
I'm sure I heard this, that the guy that took that, they paid him about $100 or something. And then it's appeared on pretty much every computer.
One of the most viewed pictures probably of all time ever.
Yeah. I think he was a successful photographer in the end, but like,
Do they even credit him?
I don't think so.
So he got no credit for it?
I don't think so. Oh, well, he has done subsequently.
Oh, I was going to say it was me that took the picture then.
Yeah.
Nobody knew who actually took that picture. Yeah. It was me. Awesome.
Yeah, but I think I don't spend any time stressing about protecting my images. I just want to be positive about it and move forward. But if there was some money in it, I might change my mind.
Yeah, but we take nice pictures because, and we vlog because we want to show our work off.
Yeah.
In essence. I mean, if nobody watched your videos and nobody give a damn about the pictures you took, I mean, that could be an interesting debate for another time, but... I wonder how often you could be bothered getting your backside out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and driving a couple of hours to take some pictures during a sunrise.
Mm.
That's interesting.
What better way to protect your images, though, than vlogging how you actually took it?
To be fair, There's no argument, is there?
Best form of copyright, isn't it?
There's no argument. Right.
Right, I think we're hitting nearly an hour there. So,
jeez, we said we were going to stop after half an hour.
It's like a little time warp, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, subscribe to us, like us. Please do share the podcast if you've enjoyed it as well with all your photography friends. And
have we said anything that we're going to get in trouble with on that one?
I don't know. I'm sure we probably
these have. are just our opinions, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
And we don't profess to know it all.
No. Definitely not.
At all. But that's it. Thanks for watching and listening.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.